It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 565 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, writer and co-creator B. Clay Moore from the Whistling Skull at Zoop.gg is our guest. An accomplished creator, Clay has written for Marvel, DC, Slave Labor Graphics, Top Cow, and several others. The Whistling Skull is described this way. Originally released as a JSA Liberty Files 6-issue series by DC Comics, the story has now been updated, re-establishing it as it was originally envisioned by the creators. We talk about this out-of-print classic that's being released as a special edition hardcover, who the characters are in this fascinating story, and what else Clay is up to. This Zoop.gg crowdfunding project will conclude around December 16. So be sure not to miss this great conversation, then support him at Zoop.gg. There's a lot to get to in this episode. So let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Clay Moore, one of the creators of a really interesting book called The Whistling Skull, the special edition hardcover from Zoop.gg. And there's a whole big story behind this, Clay. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, thanks. Just busy with this stuff and other stuff, so doing well.
As great as Zoop is, the one thing they can't do for you is do the interviews.
That's fine. It's been a while since I've done a lot of PR for anything, so it's kind of nice to talk to people again.
Okay. Now, there's a whole story behind this. Why don't I go ahead and read? There's a description of the book on the Zoop.gg page. It's a little long, but let me go ahead and read it. I think people will know a little bit better what's going on when we talk about it. It says, in a remote village in Switzerland, the townsfolk face a terrible threat. People keep disappearing without warning or explanation, and the authorities are powerless to help. But the secret organization known as the Skeleton is aware that something sinister is going on, and they've dispatched their top agents to investigate. The eerie crime fighter known as the Whistling Skull. With his assistant Knuckles at his side, the Skull can draw on the benefits of decades of crime fighting to uncover what's happening in the village. But this is not the same hero who went on all those adventures. The last Whistling Skull disappeared after fighting side by side with the heroes of his generation, and though his predecessor has the memories and skills of every man who has come before him, this one has never been on a mission before. Can the new Whistling Skull prevail when faced with pure evil, or will the horrors that were inflicted on the village soon spread to the entire world? So that's a pretty interesting story. Now, this, of course, let's talk a little bit about the history, because I think people are going to be interested in that, because I actually got the chance to reread the whole miniseries the way you put it out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still available in graphic novel format, if I'm not mistaken.
It's probably not in – you could probably pick it up here and there, but it's not currently technically in print, which is one of the reasons we were able to get the rights back and do what we're doing with it. I mean, you can, you know, like anything, you can probably find copies here or there, but it's no longer a diamond stocked book in print with DC. So,
Okay. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about the history? Because there's a story behind the story here that I think is interesting for people to know. How did this book come to be, Clay?
The series was originally published like 10 years ago in like December of 2012 is when the first issue came out. And then the rest came out in 2013, but it had actually been pitched and approved in 2007. So it's been this kind of sprawling timeline as to how we got to where we are. Tony Harris had contacted me out of the blue and had asked me if I wanted to co-create a book that he had already had titled at the time was The Further Adventures of the Whistling Skull and Brickfist. And I said, sure. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Tony co-created with James Robinson, Starman for DC in the 90s, which was one of the seminal kind of influences on me as a writer. And the opportunity to do something with Tony alone was great, but just that I was intrigued right away by the title. And he had some characters designed and in mind and kind of a loose concept, but we then kind of put our heads together and fleshed it out and built a story and the world. So we pitched it to Wildstorm, which at the time was a branch, was like an umbrella, it was under the DC umbrella, sort of like Vertigo. And at the time, Wildstorm was the only like West Coast presence for DC. So they were kind of on their own out there. Jim Lee ran Wildstorm. Ben Abernathy was our editor. DC proper was still in New York. So we had it approved at Wildstorm, started slowly building it. But Tony was finishing up a book that he did with Brian K. Vaughan called Ex Machina, which was very successful. So we always had sort of lag time. You know, we knew it was going to take a while. But before we even sort of really got into it, Wildstorm was disbanded, you know, was canceled by DC.
Right.
And so there was no more Wildstorm imprint. So obviously we weren't going to do it there. But we knew there were some creator-owned books at Wildstorm that did not end up being published. But we knew we were pretty confident that DC still wanted to do this book, and we were right. But we just knew that we would be moving into the DC proper, just DC Comics. Well, Tony, seven, 8 years earlier, had created, co-created a book called JSA, called The Liberty Files, which was sort of a Elseworlds Golden Age book featuring Justice Society doppelgangers. He and I think Dan Jolly had done that together, and they'd done a couple series, and it had done very well. And Tony didn't want this book to necessarily fall under the Vertigo imprint, because in his mind, he wanted it to be a little more all ages accessible. I mean, it's still really weird and freaky in places, but that was just something he had always had in mind, and I was fine with that. So he suggested that we bring in these characters, these JSA sort of alternate Elseworlds characters, and incorporate the skull into that universe, which I, of course, said, that's never going to happen. I mean, it's a creator-owned book. It's our own thing. DC's not going to let us bring in DC-owned elements. And then they did. So we ran with that. And they fit. They fit very well into what I had already actually written the entire series at that point, the first six issues. And then, but they fit, and partly because Tony had a hand in their creation, and it just fit the tone of what we were doing. So, so I rewrote the books to kind of use them as more of a framing device, and also to sort of just inform the larger universe we were playing with. And then DC retitled it JSA, The Liberty Files, The Whistling Skull, which is a bit awkward, but, you know, they were trying to get everybody's attention. So,
right.
So that is how it debuted, as I said, about 10 years ago now. And that first six-issue miniseries was all that was released at the time. So fast forward a few years, and certain conditions were met contractually where the rights reverted to us, except that we could not obviously use the DC characters and elements. So we had to sort of rejigger things a little bit to eliminate those and kind of shift the just tweak things enough so that the world was a little bit different than what we had presented.
That's interesting, because that doesn't happen very often.
No, I can't, honestly, I don't know. I've never seen it happen. It was, well, first of all, I never thought that DC would say, oh yeah, sure. This, like, DC was going to publish the Whistling Skull, but it was, as a creator owned book, it was still its own thing. And anytime, and when I say creator owned, I mean, that's a term that encompasses a lot of things, but basically in terms of like DC books, if somebody creates something originally, they bring it to DC, there's always a clause where at a certain point you may get the rights back, right? So it's always kind of understood that could happen. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason for people to mix, you know, characters owned by DC and Warner Brothers into that that work. But when Tony suggested, I mean, I love the JSA. I really liked what they did with the Liberty Files and the chance to kind of put our own spin on them and to help us kind of flesh out the Whistling Skulls universe. Why not? You know, now I did always know from day one, I did always kind of have it in the back of my mind that if we ever did, get the rights back and do something else with it, we'd have to deal with it when the time came. But now that's where we are now. So.
Okay. So how much did you have to adapt? Because I recently went back and reread the whole original, I think it was 6 issues.
Yes.
And I'm just kind of curious because when I was reading it, and of course I had this all in mind about the fact that you were doing the Zoop and you were going to have to alter some of the stuff, I didn't see a whole lot of stuff that needed to be changed. Now, as I said, Our Man and Dr. Midnight are in it. And there's mentions of the JSA here and there. But as far as that goes, I didn't think that you were going to have to do a lot of tinkering in order to fix it, to make it so it didn't happen. But how much did you actually have to do?
That's correct. We didn't have to do a lot. And partly because, as I said, I had already written – we had already plotted and written the first 6 issues without those characters. So I had to kind of revise things to mix them in. And because the folk, you know, the main idea was to introduce the world, tell a story that sort of set the ground rules and was, you know, it's a very pulpy noir kind of set in the 40s thing. It was more important for us to tell the story of the skull than tell stories about the JSA type characters. So having done it that way made it a lot easier than if I had sort of sunk them into the book from the beginning and, you know, they played a major role in the story. So really it was just a matter of kind of reconfiguring the heroes that we used from DC. And also you mentioned the references. What we had done was we had this idea for this larger world of the skull where he's one of many mystery men or adventurers. And it was easy to just take DC and the 52 and the JSA and kind of graft them onto that. Well, extracting them from that just gives us a chance to sort of reposition and redirect the world on our own terms. But you're right. There wasn't a lot that needed to be done. Tony tweaked some of the art. I re-scripted different parts of the book based on that. Dave McKaig, who was the original series colorist, who I think did a phenomenal job, offered to sort of tweak the color so that it printed. Having seen it in print, we knew what we would want to tweak a little bit to get it to look exactly the way we wanted. So he did that. The process wasn't painful. But we did complete all that. That was one of the things we wanted to do, was make sure everything was in place and ready to go before Zoop launched their campaign. So no, it was not massive. Because again, the focus was always on the Whistling Skull and his personal universe. And that's where it is now.
I do find the art really creepy.
Well, it's by design.
It's really, really creepy. And I just, yeah, no. I enjoyed the, I'm there's so many things I want to ask. I hope I can get them all in the right proper order here, but, I thought before I get into too much about it, we would talk about who the characters actually are. Mm-hmm. According to an Entertainment Weekly review that's up, that's listed on Zoop, it says that the Whistling Skull and the Sidekick Knuckles are actually William Massey and Nigel Singleton, Brit boyhood friends who've grown up to fight Nazis and other criminals in 1940s Europe. So that's the thing I'm curious about is, well, the organization is called Skeleton, so it's not bad to think that one of its agents is going to be have a skull name to it. But why is he called the Whistling Skull?
Well, to kind of talk about all that, the Skeleton is actually the organization that supports the Whistling Skull across the globe and his in endeavors. So the Whistling Skull is actually a generational hero. So this is like, so this William Massey is one of a line of Whistling Skulls. And the previous Whistling Skull, it's revealed in the story. It's understood in the story that Nigel, who is Knuckles, his father was the previous Whistling Skull, but he's not really aware of that. He's limited. I don't know how to describe it best without, but he's, so Nigel is a young man who's sort of stuck at about the level of a 9 or 10 year old. And as a young boy, William had befriended him as basically a street urchin and just kind of looked out for him and became his friend. And they had always been close. So the previous skull, Knuckles' father, saw that relationship, and that's one of the reasons that the mantle ended up being passed down to William Massey when the previous skull disappears, which we do delve into a little bit without revealing everything. As for why he's called the Whistling Skull, Tony had the name and design in place, and he is a skull with a steam whistle in his head. So at some point, Tony, in terms of his inspiration, you never know where it's going to come from, which is one of the reasons I love working with him. He just throws anything at the wall. And when I first saw that design attached to the name, I might want to say, well, why would this have happened or this had been the design, you know, in the real world that he exists in. But I think when you see it all and you see it all together, you're kind of like, okay, that makes sense. So as for Knuckles, one of the things that, so, as I said, his father was the previous Whistling Skull, and he would travel the world on these adventures and what have you, aided and abetted by the Skeleton, which would be the agents around the world that help him out. And one of the things he had done when Nigel was younger was he discovered this salve, like this lotion from I think we describe it as a group of peaceful monks that when applied to the skin repeatedly, the skin becomes toughened and hardened almost like steel. So he had sent this back to his son in case he would need to defend himself from the people who might bully him. And so Knuckles can punch the hell out of anything as a result. As I said, the book it's set in the '40s. It's got a very pulp noir and sort of weird in the classic sense sensibility, as you mentioned with the artwork. So a lot of that kind of stuff sort of echoes things you might have seen back in the days of the pulps or what have you. This kind of mysterious world that exists outside the boundaries of our reality. So that's the Whistling Skull, that's Knuckles, that's the Skeleton. And then one of the other things we kind of established, and this was really just through the process of seeing pages Tony drew and how he drew characters, was that the Skeleton, there are agents of the Skeleton that are a little weird and off kilter as well that, you know, we run into throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. Now I get Nigel Knuckles. I get that. That's the N sound to the beginning of the word. Does that make?
Well, I mean, just look at the Whistling Skull. Like I said, he's a skull with a whistle. So, I mean, there you go. And actually, I don't even remember if we address it in the book, but originally there was the idea that this whistle became sort of a sound that would announce his presence to, you know, to bad guys or what have you. You know, when you hear this whistle, you know that you're in trouble. And I don't know that we really leaned into that in this series, but I think that was the original idea.
Okay. Something we can look forward to. That's a question I want to get to later about the future of the Whistling Skull and stuff like that. But as far as this story goes, it says in here that you've introduced some new characters. Of course, the JSA is they're funny that they're coming back right about the same time. But can you talk about which new characters you've introduced in this book?
Yeah. What we've kind of done is... So, as I said, I'm a fan of the whole, you know, pop culture gamut from beginning, you know, from the beginning of time to now. But I growing up, I was always a big fan of the weird Golden Age characters that I kind of discovered after I discovered the main characters that always intrigued me. You know, like the Justice Society became favorites of mine because after I started reading comics, I found some. They didn't really have a presence in comics at the time, but I found some back issues and there were like these weird different versions of the characters I had known. And so I sort of became obsessed with learning everything about those guys and learned that they had gone stretched all the way back into the 30s. So what I like about those characters is that back in the 40s, when they would create a character that was successful, there would be all kinds of variations of that type of character, you know, like, the Flash, you know, there was the Flash and the Whizzer and Quicksilver and Johnny Quick and Aquaman, Submariner, the Finn, you know, there were all these. So like one of the first books I did when I started doing comics was a creator owned book with Jeremy Hahn at Image called Battle Hymn, which was set in the Golden Age and was sort of a more hardline real world version. But we used characters that were tropes based on the kinds of characters you would have seen there, right? So what we've done then with the Whistling Skull is kind of take that approach with the new heroes that we've introduced. So like one hero is the Night Surgeon, and he's the assumption is he's blind, but the reality is that his eyes are so sensitive. He has these, and again, this is all kind of comic book science that we're working with and trying to make it seem plausible and realistic. But So like his goggles are always bombarding his eyes with light particles, which enables him to discern shapes and what have you. Otherwise his eyes are so sensitive that he would see right. You know, he would see everything on a molecular level or whatever. There's another character, named Day Knight, DayKnight, who is, sort of along the lines of Hourman and guys like that. He's his power waxes and wanes throughout, you know, based on the time of day or what have you. And then they're part of a larger group. So the larger network of heroes that we had already had in mind when we did the Whistling Skull, we just called them the 52 at the time because of DC. You know, DC was all about the new 52 and right. The 52 world. So we were like, well, let's just use that name. And then we'll assume there are like 52 heroes or groups of heroes out there. We've reconceptualized that. And now it's called the Wheel of Justice. And so there's this, the idea is that at the very center of the wheel is this group that would be similar to the JSA, which is called the Company in shorthand. And then the further out you get from that hub, sort of the less connection they have, right? So the Whistling Skull is sort of at the edge of the wheel, so to speak. He's kind of operates on his own terms, but these guys are aware of him and kind of keep tabs on him. So basically the idea behind the Wheel of Justice is that it encompasses every costumed adventurer or mystery man or whatever out there in this core group, of which the Night Surgeon and Day Knight are members of, are aware of them. They know where they are. If they need their assistance, they know, you know, if they're in a region where they know these people operate, they'll work with them. And also they keep tabs on them just to kind of know what they're up to and, you know, and know whether they need to keep a closer eye on them or not. So I don't know, that probably over-explains the situation, but that's kind of the context of the world we've built within this world.
Well, it's kind of cool. I like stories from that era, and I'm always interested. I was just reading today about how Superman and Batman, when they first appeared, they were actually a lot more aggressive, shall we say.
Than
they were later on and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
But that, of course, all leads me to the bad guys of the piece, which are really interesting. And there's a page of it on Zoop.gg. If you go to Zoop.gg/C/cat/whistlingskull, you'll get to see some of the pages on there. And one of the pages shows the bad guys, and they're called Der Carnival, which I'm sure I butchered in German. It's probably pronounced a little different. But they've got a group of heroes, you've got a group of bad guys. I love the names of them. One of them is Serpentina, mm-hmm. and the Strong Man, and the Boneless, which always, I don't understand how somebody can be a threat if they're boneless like that, but that's all right. And then you've got the Pocket, and mm-hmm. what's the name of the main bad guy who's got kind of different color skin?
Remember? Oh, you're talking, Jesus. You're talking about the lead Nazi doctor. Now I can't.
I put you on the spot.
I can't remember what we call him. It's been, he's basically like an extreme version of the Nazi scientist who would experiment on people, and these characters you mentioned are, without giving too much away, they are the result of some of his experimentation. And then they travel around under the guise of this carnival. All those characters are sort of, while that is the main sort of threat, you know, the plot line of the story is trying to figure out what happened to the missing villagers, who Der Carnival is, what their relationship is with everything. Those are all, again, sort of the main idea was to introduce the Skull and Knuckles and the supporting characters and kind of establish the world and their relationship and then kind of examine how they would go about solving this crime, what they would have to rely on to do so, especially first time out of the gate. So those characters are designed to kind of establish the parameters of the world we have and, you know, how weird it'll get without getting completely bonkers, you know, off the rails. And I think they serve that pretty well. It's not like a classic whodunit mystery where the whole idea is to figure out exactly what's going on. It's more about watching the characters work their way through the story as they figure out what's going on and then kind of get a better understanding. And it's very character focused. I mean, you know, we hope that you mentioned the Entertainment Weekly review, which we had posted on the Zoop page. I had had that bookmarked forever because it's a great review. I mean, you know, they said, you know, one of the best books at the tail end of the year. And I mean, it's a phenomenal review, but more than that, it really gets what we're trying to do with the book and the world and everything, and really enjoyed it on those terms. So that's one of the reasons that when we were talking about this campaign, I said, well, let's link to this because, first of all, it's Entertainment Weekly, so it's not, you know, it's not like our friends writing a review for us.
Right.
But it's a very literate, enthusiastic review that really sort of explains what we're going for. So you learn throughout the story the reality of Der Carnival and who those characters really are. But you mentioned the Boneless, and that's actually sort of one of my favorite characters, just because Tony, you talk about creepy. I mean, he really went to town on this character. You know, he's sort of like Plastic Man or Mr. Fantastic if he doesn't stretch so much. You know, he can wrap himself around you and slither around and what have you. Tony, you know, I mentioned Ex Machina, which was sort of photo referenced and more photorealistic. Well, he really did this beautiful stylized art for this book so that it could be, as you said, more creepy and can kind of push the drawings a little bit more. And there's some crazy angles and action sequences. And having not really sat down and reread the book in a long time. When we went through this and I kind of sat down with it, I was again struck just by how much I love what Tony and Dave McKeag on color did with the art. I just think it's so much fun and it's kinetic. And I mean, I don't know. I don't see how you couldn't be drawn to the artwork on some level.
It's creepy. I mean, as I'm sitting looking at the pages on the Zoop.gg page, yike. It's with the Whistling Skull, even his appearances.
Oh, yeah. And Tony Leans, I mean, he did a new painting for the cover, and it's the Whistling Skull seated in a chair with knuckles behind him with his hand on his head. And I know he's got like blood, you know, like dripping from the jaws of the Whistling Skull. I mean, he really, in the close-ups and everything, he really pushes the kind of weird, creepy factor, which again, you can do when you're not, you know, trying to do photorealistic work.
Right. Now, the name of the story interests me. It's called The Big Dirt Nap, mm-hmm. which is, if I remember my parents, like that often meant being buried or like dying and being put in the grave. It was considered a big dirt nap. Is that, am I accurate on that? Is that what that's about?
You are. Yeah. It's, again, it was, so that was a name that, Tony had come up with, I maybe before we plotted it, he wanted to use that title, but, if you're going to be specific about it, it sort of references one of the things we flash back and forth to a little bit is the fate of the previous skull, and also efforts to find him. So, and that sort of subplot is intended to lead into a later story, but, yeah, the previous Whistling Skull is dealing with the after effects of a big dirt nap. And that is the thing that sort of is the catalyst that gets the whole new skull and knuckles, on the road. So it's, and it's just Tony, I like the sound of it. And Tony, so I was like, all right, we'll just use that and, you know, let people sort of suss it out. But yeah, but you're correct in the big, yeah, you're absolutely right about what it refers to.
It's interesting because we get to see a lot of the world.
Professor Hellman. Sorry.
Hellman. Okay.
That's the name of the doctor.
So I was kind of poking around looking for it too. Well,
just struck me as you were talking.
Oh, good. I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that, but
no, it's just like, I haven't, I mean, it wasn't part of the story that I tweaked or screwed with really. So I had to think about it, but we've got a lot of characters that we introduced throughout there. So,
well, it's a really interesting story. I got to sit and read it. I'm going to be really curious because I backed it on Zoop.gg, which I
appreciate that.
I highly encourage people to do. There are some really interesting levels to this. There's a signed hardcover that you can get. Of course, by the time this posts, that may be passed. It's only for the first 24 hours, so that's probably long gone. But you can actually get a remarked hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
yeah, Tony's, something. Yeah, Tony's going to do sketches on a special book plate that he created for the book.
And it's 132 pages. You can get the hardcover version. You can get the digital copy. I don't see a trade version of it. I think you guys just have the hardcover and digital.
Right. Yeah, that was the idea, is we wanted to present it in this really kind of custom special format. Who knows what we might do down the road if we, you know, depending on what we decide to do with the characters and their world from here.
But that's a question I want to ask in just a minute or two. But the add-ons kind of intrigue me. You've got a pin and a vinyl sticker of a logo of sorts for the Whistling Skull, with mm-hmm. a skull with a top with a hat on, and it's tilted sideways. You don't actually see the whistle. I was looking through the pages, and you do see that whistle coming out of his head in many of the art pieces. And then there's art prints, and then you can get a head sketch by Tony and a Whistling Skull coffin box. Now, there's only one of seven in existence. That intrigues me very much. Somebody's, it hasn't been claimed yet. There's only seven in existence. I guess there's only one chance to get it, and maybe by the time this post, that'll be gone.
That's something Tony built way back when we pitched it, and he probably should have. I guess it does say what's in there. Text pieces, series overview, props and trinkets, handmade. So he's got there's like a skeleton hand and all kind. When we first pitched it, he wanted to do these really special custom wooden boxes with ephemera from the series to send to editorial, which I don't think was necessary because they were going to approve it anyway. But he did, and they're super. I mean, it's really cool and obviously unique because there's only a handful in existence.
Wow, that's kind of cool. Unfortunately, it's about $500, which is a little out of my price range, so I couldn't really go for that.
It's definitely especially for the Tony Harris collector, but it is definitely a unique, one-of-a-kind item.
Now, I'm curious about the story, because one of the things the story does is it moves around within the places in World War II. You're in Japan at one point. I think it starts out in Japan in 1940, and then it moves to Germany. And it's in different places and stuff like that. I thought I saw England or someplace when I was reading it.
They're based in England. They're English.
Was that on purpose to go around and kind of visit the places that the war kind of impacted and do those kind of things in the story?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's since that's the period in which these characters are operating, that's where they might have dealt with, you know, localized trouble, which is really what they kind of focus on. They're not, you know, the Whistling Skull is not heading into the heart of the Nazi Empire to take on Hitler, but he's dealing with things on the fringes that need seeing to. Like for instance, most of this story takes place in like the Swiss Alps. In the previous skull is the larger world, like there's a group called, we call them These Gentlemen Body Snatchers, and their job is to go clean up the scene of adventures that the skull might have had. So one of the things they're doing in the background is trying to locate the original, what happened to the last skull who vanished, you know, in Japan while he was fighting these giant idols with like ball and chain swinging weaponry that Tony designed. It stood logically to reason that that is where the most intense conflicts would be going on, even beyond the battlefield. So that's where they take place. But also we do flashback. One of the things that the current skull is he sort of has the memories, specific memories of the previous incarnations of the skull sort of psychologically embedded in his memory so that he can draw upon their experiences if he runs into something that would require them to do so. And one of the ways we sort of visually demonstrate that is for him to flash back on the adventures of a previous skull. So like one is in Afghanistan years later, you know, one is at the Battle of Verdun. Because he's new to the game, it's a little overwhelming to him when these images come to him as he's dealing with things. But along those lines, previous skulls and maybe skulls in the future from here would have been active in whatever hot spots were going on at the time they were active.
So you've touched on something that interests me, and there are a lot of supergroups that are time locked, and we mentioned the JSA and their return, which has been a difficult process over the decades, because anything that's time group locked, when they're involved with World War II, and the longer it goes after World War II, then the harder it is to bring those characters back because they've gotten so old by comparison, right? And stuff like that.
Well, that's why Earth 2 was created to begin with, was to help explain how there could have been a Batman in World War II if you're still reading the Batman adventures, you know, in the mid to late 60s.
But how's that going to affect the Whistling Skull and the skeleton group and stuff like that? You've been talking about that there might be future adventures for them. Are they going to be in the 1940s, or are they going to shift around in time periods, or how you plan to handle that?
So the original idea with this, with the first six issues, was we talked to DC Editorial about this, and it was kind of the plan initially was to start with a series and then eventually tell about 40 issues worth of stories about this particular Whistling Skull. So we would sort of follow him from the beginning of his career to the end of his career, and however much time that encompassed. So that's probably where we would go next, is to continue to follow the adventures of this version of the character. But there's also room, because it's a generational character, there's always room to go back and tell stories of previous versions. Now, at the core of the character, there's a sort of a law firm in London called Teagle & Sons that has been in charge of sort of caretaking the Whistling Skull legacy throughout the years. And because they're in London, the law firm is, you know, well over 100 years old in 1940. And so as well as doing whatever business they do, they also sort of safeguard and shepherd this legacy. So as the new Skull emerges, because we tell the story of the new Skull from kind of, we jump around a little bit. It's not completely linear, but we see him as a child, how he and Knuckles / Nigel became friends, how it became decided that he was the next Skull in line. And so we meet these weird and creepy characters associated with Teagle and Sons that are sort of in charge of training and finding and building the Skull, the new, you know, each Skull. So we would assume that there are different versions of these characters throughout the decades, or different characters who have the same function within the, you know, different versions of the Whistling Skull's career. It's not the way we've set it up. It's pretty easy to jump wherever we want to, because it's a character that is, it's a mantle that is taken up by different people throughout time.
That's cool, because I'd be curious to see what the Whistling Skull would look like today.
Yeah. There's no reason we couldn't follow the story anywhere. And because we own, you know, it's ours now, we own the rights to it. I mean, there's no reason, it would be possible to cross over with, you know, other characters that, you know, we create or already own or what have you in different eras. So, that's one of the things about it. In terms of trying to establish the universe, and that there's more, you know, more costumed adventures and stuff out there than we see here, is it always opens the door to, if we do more, we could do stories about other characters in the same universe, or, you know, bring them into future stories or what have you. So it really expands the world of possibilities.
The Skullniverse or something like that.
Yeah, the Skullniverse. That's, I'm writing that down now. I'm going to pretend I came up with it.
Anything we do on here is totally free, believe me. You want to use us, perfectly up to you. But
yeah, I like that. It's better shorthand than the universe of the Whistling Skull.
Yeah, kind of stuff. I read the original book, and it's really fascinating to me. It's going to be, I'm always interested in these kinds of stories, because I also like historical books that are factual. Like this takes place in the 40s, and there's none of today's ways of thinking introduced into it. You're very faithful to the time that this takes place in, and I always appreciate that. I always hate it when we go back to a time like the 1800s and suddenly all the women are doing everything and the men are all sitting on the sidelines and stuff like that. I'm going, that wasn't the way it was back then. But right. You guys do a great job with that.
That's largely a function of having grown up, you know, even as a kid in the 80s, being sort of aware of and obsessed with pop culture from different eras. So it's like the first thing the Hawaiian Dig was the first thing I did at Image, which is set in the 50s in Hawaii. Battleham was set in the 40s. Did a book. I've jumped around into different eras because I sort of internalized, just through exposure to, you know, movies and TV and books and the reality of those eras. So kind of to what you're talking about, one of the ways I've always looked at it is that I'm staying true to the era to some degree, but I'm also always aware of our perceptions of the era. And so I kind of like to play around with those a little bit too. Applying a complete modern sensibility to the past kind of defeats the purpose of being there to begin with, I think.
That always pulls me right out of what I'm reading.
So you say that, and it's funny you say that, because that is another, I have a small list of real hardcore philosophies. And when I'm editing or somebody's asking me for advice on something, the things I always point to are anything at all that takes the reader out of the story. And those sort of, when you run up against something like that and you're forced to stop and think about it, wait, that doesn't make sense. You know, whatever it completely derails the experience. So yeah.
That's what happened to me.
Tony mentioned that when we were doing the book. He was like, boy, the language and everything, you've really got all this down. And I'm like, I can just kind of reflect on things I'm familiar with from the era and sort of try to reflect that sensibility.
I always talk about Rocky IV. How in the middle of this whole thing, Rocky's fighting this juiced up Soviet guy, and he manages to beat him. And in the middle of the Soviet Union, they give him an open mic.
Yeah, so he can give a speech about
how terrible it is. I remember sitting all of a sudden just, whoop, I'm sitting in the theater watching the movie instead of in the movie. And I was like, oh, rats. I hate when that happens.
Now, I'll say that. It's interesting that that's the point of Rocky IV where it didn't seem realistic to you.
So, but you do a wonderful job of keeping us in the moment, which I think is really important for historical books like this and stuff.
Thanks. Now, I'll say this about Rocky IV, though. That movie now is actually interesting to watch for that reason, because – it really is a reflection of kind of what our perspective was, in the 80s about the, the rush, what I mean? It doesn't work as historical accuracy, but it works in terms of our sort of xenophobic approach to Russia and everything else. So.
Of course, it doesn't exist anymore either. It's not the Soviet Union. Right. So all those things are all past. But the one thing I haven't mentioned so far, and people are going to get mad at me because I do this all the time, I get involved in talking about the book and I don't talk about the deadline. And the deadline for this is going to be, as I read it, is December 16th, sometime in that day. Although it might extend if they have a good reason to. But as we're talking, we're recording this a little early. You're well on your way to getting you have a goal of $10,000, and I think that's going to be easy to get, and I think we're going to see lots of good things. Do you have ideas already for, like, the Whistling Skull 2 or something? Do you have other things in mind for that?
Yeah, we do. Somewhere I still have notes on what we had discussed as to what the follow-up story would be, which was, again, a title of Tony's. Tony will have an idea for, like, the adventure, like I described sort of Der Carnival and Helmet and all that. And then what we would do is build sort of the character development and growth around that story. But he had an idea years ago called The Murder Hole. H-O-L-E, The Murder Hole. Mm-hmm. He had a scene in mind to introduce this story. And so I, just because we had talked about that so long ago and kind of built some things around it, if we pick up the Skull's adventures right after this, that would probably be where we'd start. The Murder Hole, which is more creepy, dead bodies thrown in a hole. There's more to it than that. But
sounds creepy to me. I would be interested to see that and stuff like that. Is it likely you'll do that? Is it possible?
It's so like when we got the rights back, I knew that, I knew we would want to do something with it. There are a lot of options out there in terms of, would we, if we did a new series, would we start by by tweaking this first one and publishing it? And so, but we didn't really have any concrete plans until I think Zoop might have approached him about other things or ideas or what have you. And because they both kind of, at the same time, Tony and Zoop looped me in and asked about this. And I thought it was a great way to represent it as we want it to be. It's been 10 years, so there's a lot of people who haven't seen it probably, and people who have would hopefully be interested in the new take. So it gives us a baseline from which to build future stories. There's no reason, I guess, we couldn't do an original, second chapter the same way we did this one. But I definitely want to follow up and pursue it. It's just really a matter of schedule juggling. And what it's like I said, the first series was approved in 2007 and didn't come out till 2012, largely because, you know, we knew it would be easier for Tony than trying to juggle, you know, two monthly books at one time or whatever. So it's really just a function of kind of figuring out the schedule and how to make sure it's published the way we want it to and what have you. So long way to say, yes, I would like to do more with the Skull, and we have some ideas in mind.
Well, these aren't really superheroes. They're like horror heroes.
Right, yeah. They're sort of mystery men.
Well, and there's something different than what we really get today. We're so into superheroes and costume characters like Superman and the like that we don't really have a variation on this heroic play the way this is. And I think there's a place for that because there's a lot of horror books out. But to make a blend of superhero and horror, I think would be something that I think would have a lot of appeal.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, we keep talking about it being set in the past and that sensibility, but it's definitely not, you know, it's not cheesy and it's designed for people to enjoy today, you know, as modern readers and not necessarily just for nostalgia's sake. So hopefully people clue into that.
It's really gripping, I have to say. I couldn't stop reading it once I started. And
thank you.
There are certain stories I want to have on my bookshelf that when I am in the mood for a longer story, I want to pull it out and read it. And this is one of those because it's creative and different. I love variety in my reading, and this is very different from, you know, even from if you read the Justice Society era, that it's very different from that. Even, you know, when you did it, you started out with something that was very unique. And I always appreciate something that is a variety and takes me places I haven't been before. And the Whistling Skull really does that.
Well, I appreciate that.
And once again, it's at zoop.gg/C4/Whistling Skull. And I just think it's going to be a big success on Zoop, and I'm looking forward to seeing. I'd love to see more about it because it's creepy and yet heroic at the same time, and I'm not used to that. So I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I think Clay, that I hope there's a lot of Whistling Skull in your future as well as other stuff. Speaking of which, are there other projects that you're working on that we should be aware of?
Yeah, I'm actually. Most of what I'm working on now is intended for you know, well, obviously it's November, but I mean, we'll be sort of mid to late next year. Mac Chater is an artist that I've been working with on a couple of things. He's a British artist who recently did, I think he did a Stranger Things issue and had done Briggs Land at Dark Horse in the past. But he and I have a book that's scheduled to be out next summer that's sort of a political vampire horror thing, survivalist kind of story that we've been working on for a few years. I mean, literally, we've been working on it since pre-COVID. So, and then he and I also have another thing that's sort of a midnight detective kind of thing that we may do in a series of graphic novels. And there are other things that are in the works as well, kind of in early stages with people. But most of what I do tends to lean into, at least these days, and it's sort of creator-owned, you know, original concepts. And so I've got multiple things in the works along those lines. So when the time comes, I'll shout and you know, let people know.
And if people want to keep up with what you're up with, are you on social media? Do you have a website? How do people do that?
Yeah, I would just – I'm still on Twitter. It's pretty much – just about every, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, which I wish more people use because it's fun to throw a lot of stuff up. Facebook, you could follow me. It's all B. Clay Moore, just one word. You know, it's whatever. Twitter, slash B. Clay Moore, Instagram, whatever. It's it's pretty easy to find me. Twitter is probably the best place to start. And my Twitter bio has links to everything else. So.
Very cool. Well, I have to say, I really enjoyed this book. I can't wait to read it with the changes and see just what differences you guys put into it and see what else you got coming in the future, because I think that's going to be great fun. So keep up the wonderful stuff, Clay. I think I see good things in the future, hopefully for the Skullverse and whatever else you're working on.
The Skullverse. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
people need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.